Court. My name is Joanne Herlihy on behalf of the appellant Camp Bird Colorado, Inc. Camp Bird Colorado, Inc. and its predecessors in interest have owned a private road traversing 5 mining claims, also owned by Camp Bird Colorado since it was created, the road, by Thomas Walsh in or about 1898. But because of legal, procedural, and factual errors by the trial court erroneously held that this private road is a public road owned by Ouray County. Any one of these errors is cause for a new trial, but the cumulative effect of these errors and the unfair trial to which Camp Bird was thus subjected requires reversal of the trial court's decision and remand to the trial court for a new trial. I'll first discuss the 3 legal errors that we have raised. Number 1, the res judicata effect of the quiet title decree entered in 1984. Number 2, the trial court's erroneous finding that the road was a public road under the RS-2477 statute, and the trial court's erroneous conclusion that under 43-2-201 the road was claimed by the county under adverse possession. With respect to the quiet title decree that was entered by the county, or by the court, Ouray County District Court, in 1984, that created a res judicata preclusive effect against the county's raising the title to the road in this case, or claiming a defense. The parties were the same in that case. The Camp Bird Colorado, Inc. had filed a quiet title action against a number of parties, including the county of Ouray. The claims in this case were the same, except with the exception of one, the Agnew.
Let me stop you there, Ms. Hurley. Would you agree with me that the complaint in that action from 1983 or 1984 was very specific? As I recall, there were 14 claims. Each claim was against specific defendants and named specific things. Here, if I remember, was claim 14, was against Ouray County. It had nothing, that claim had nothing to do with the properties in issue in this case. Isn't that true?
That claim did not mention the properties at issue, but the overall action was a quiet title action, and under Rule 105, and under the Argus Real Estate case that was decided, you have the obligation to raise any claims, issues, or defenses that you might have regarding the properties at issue in a quiet title action.
Regarding properties at issue, which were
properties were at issue in the quiet title action.
Relating to other defendants.
Well, they were at issue in the case.
So your position is, although your client framed the issue in a very specific way, 20 years later it can use that against the board because they didn't anticipate an argument you were going to make?
Well, I think they should have anticipated it because the factual matter existing at the time, I don't think that the county at that time thought it had an interest in the road.
Why didn't you plead it?
Because we didn't have to. We'd been blocking the road for since the 1960s. There was a gate at either end of the road from the testimony established from at least 1968. Through up until a year or so ago after the trial court's decision came out. So if the county had thought it had an interest in the road, it should have asserted it then. So in other words, there was a res judicata.
I've looked at the pleadings. I think we all have looked at the pleadings. And you can characterize that as one quiet title action. It is also possible, I think, to characterize it as 14 quiet title actions involving separate defendants as to each quiet title action. I mean, I grant you counsel merged them into one complaint, but they're all freestanding claims and could have been brought totally separately.
I think the purpose of a quiet title action under the Argus case and Rule 105 is to bring all the parties together, bring all the claims together, and if you have a claim, if you're named in the case, you better bring it. I think that's the answer. I want to move on to the RS-2477 argument. The trial court found that all but the Glenn Monarch claim were established under RS-2477, but you can't make that finding that was an error of law by the trial court because since the Glenn Monarch had been withdrawn from the public domain prior to the stated dates of the county's declaration, if we will, of the public trail in 1878 and 79, the Glenn Monarch being withdrawn from the public domain was no longer subject to RS-2477.
Let me ask you a question on that. I think the Glen Monarch claim had been staked, for lack of a better term,
It was
prior
located.
to 1878.
It was located in 1876.
Yes, okay. The certificate of location was not filed until 1880.
Yes, but it was located.
What constitutes withdrawal from the public domain?
Location, Your Honor.
And what is your authority for that?
My authority is the Dahl case, United States Supreme Court case, the Gwillim case, which is also United States Supreme Court case.
Can you give me, are those in your brief?
Those are in my brief, okay. Your Honor. And the McFeeder case, which is a Colorado State Supreme Court case. So basically what ended up happening then is that because the Glen Monarch had already been withdrawn from the public domain by location prior to the time the county declared or stated a public trail, there could be no road by RS-2477 because it terminated at either end, either border line of the Glen Monarch claim.
Ms. Hurley, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could you explain for me what what location means and how is that different, if it is, from entry? The Leach case, for one, that's cited in maybe both of your briefs, talks about entry, and it seems to suggest, this is a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1938, seems to suggest that the date of entry is the date we look at. Perhaps you can define those terms for me.
Well, Your Honor, basically in the mining law, the date of entry and the date of location are almost synonymous. The date of entry is basically your physical walking onto the property and, as you pointed out, Judge Roy, literally putting the stakes in the ground. And that is also basically the date of your location. Now, we've got evidence, and what we have here is evidence of the record. I can't tell you today, standing here, when somebody actually physically walked on that property. But I can tell you, based on the surveys, or based on the location certificates that were filed, the date that they said that they did that. And those were notarized, and those were duly recorded, and they've been recorded for over 100 years. So you really can't challenge the fact that the location was the date on the location certificates. So the Glen Monarch was, as a matter of fact, withdrawn from the public domain under the case law and not available for RS-2477 declaration as a public road or trail as of 1876. So cut off on either end an RS-2477 claim. The third error of law was that there was no adverse possession under the state statute 43-2-201.
Ms. Rowley, I'm sorry to interrupt again. I want to make sure I'm understanding. I guess my impression from the case is whether the entry had to do with filing something. Your position is it's not, that it's just when you physically enter on the land?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
No adverse possession. The declarations of in 1878 and 1879 were not accompanied by any map. There was no reference in the minutes of those declarations or statements to any map. There was no plat. There was no survey accompanying those county minutes, as was required, as is required by the statute 43-2-201. So as a matter of law, simply the declaration under those 1878 and 1879 minutes that the road was public under that statute fails. There was no due process because it was also, you can't find a definite or certain line of whatever it was they were trying to declare. And the second problem with 43-2-201 is that to create the public easement under that statute, you had to be making the declaration on private lands. Well, those lands were not private. Those mining claims were not private, or the last one was made, quote unquote, private in 1924. So to declare, so the declaration in 1878 and 1879, before those mining claims were made private, and in fact, most of them weren't made private until after that time, you can't just use that. It was a failure as a matter of law that those declarations established adverse possession under 43-2-201.
Ms. Hurley, what about if we start with 1924 for a 20-year period after that?
Let's say we start with 1924. There's nothing in the evidence in the record to show the test of the three adverse possession claims. There is no evidence that members of the public used the road from 1924 until we have Mr. Staley's testimony that he remembers using the road starting maybe in mid-1950s. We have no evidence that the landowner, Camp Bird, or its predecessors in interest had actual or implied knowledge and made no objection. And we don't have any evidence in the record that the public used the road without interruption for the statutory 20-year period. The three things that we have that we can, that are in the record that we can establish a time frame of are Mr. Staley's testimony about using the road starting in the mid-50s, and he said it was uninterrupted. But we also have the undisputed testimony in the record that Camp Bird cut that off in 1960, by no later than 1968, by putting gates on either end of the road. And that testimony came from Mr. Rosemeyer, who worked on that property from early 60s, late 50s, early 60s onward, until basically the Camp Bird mine closed. We also have a 1961 county map that shows that road as being located in the thing, but it also doesn't have a number. And there's a note on that county map that says all unnumbered roads are private. So there's evidence that the county in 1961 thought the road was private. And finally, we do have the evidence of the chaining, undisputed evidence of the chaining and the gates at either end of that road that cuts off access beginning in 1968. So between 1924 and 1968, we do not have any 20-year, any evidence, any hard evidence in the record of a 20-year period that meets all three tests under McIntyre.
Well, I don't have all of Judge Mitchell's factual findings in my fingertips, but didn't he make factual findings that were contrary to what you just said about the period from 1924 through 1968, that there was some request by people from Camp Bird to have the road maintained, or that members of the public used the part of the road in question for hiking or traveling?
You know, Your Honor, the record, if you go back and look, the record will show that those activities happened after 1968, as a matter of fact. Hiking, road plowing, those things happened after 1968 when the road was already gated and the county had keys that were given to it by Camp Bird.
So are you saying that Judge Mitchell made no factual findings at all concerning activities between 1924 and 1968?
That's correct. I mean, he did say that the public used the road, but there was no basis for that finding. I mean, between the time period of 1924 and 1919, Mr. Staley used the road in the 1950s. What I'm saying, it was, but all right, so between 1924 and mid-1950s, there was no 20-year period where the court said, here's something that happened, and it continued for 20 years. There's no finding. All the court said was there was public use. But based on what? There was no fact to base that statement on in that time frame.
Counsel, I guess I'm a little confused by your argument. I mean, the judge also found he said an 1882 survey shows the road at issue is public. Abstract from testimony in 1905 case suggests that. 1902 U.S. Geological Survey shows the road at issue. He cites whole bunches of maps going back.
But where's the use? He cites maps, but there's no evidence of use by the public. There's the other two tests of McIntyre that were not satisfied. I'd like to move on to the procedural.
Well, didn't he also say, I mean, I think he made a finding there was public use, and he talked about driving, you know, maps up and down and wagons, and it was wide enough for a wagon. Doesn't that, assuming.
Well, wide enough for a wagon when? After 1924?
He said an 1882 survey shows a road at issue as a public trail, as does an 1886 map showing it as a wagon road. Doesn't that give at least an inference that it was used for the purpose that the map shows it for?
Well, I think, Your Honor, if you look at what legally had to happen in order to create a public road, I think the court made the wrong legal inference.
But that's a different question. There is some evidence here to suggest that this road was used as a wagon road in 1886. Is there not?
But does that mean it's a public road? I don't think so. It was a private road. It was the Camp Bird Road. And I think those findings of fact were wrong.
There are two segments of the road, as I understand it. The road segment in issue goes up and joins another road or trail. Above that trail, there seems to be no question but what is public.
Correct. There's the road that goes past the junction that we're talking about, goes up to the Yankee Boy Basin. I mean, if you're looking at it, goes up to the Yankee Boy Basin, goes up to Sneffels, and then comes over the top. And then that, the road that we're talking about is kind of a triangle between that. And then that road continues up.
You're confusing me. I've looked at the maps, and I think I know what I'm talking about.
All right, I'm sorry.
The road segment comes up from the bridge.
Yes, it does.
And joins another road.
Correct.
Okay.
There's no dispute about that.
Above that road, above that junction, there's no question but what it's public.
Correct.
Does the evidence, when the evidence talks about snow removal, talks about maintenance, talks about all these other things, is it clear that it's talking about the road below that junction, or is it talking about the road above that junction? Because obviously road maintenance and snow removal above that junction would not be evidence that this is a public segment.
It's talking about the evidence was snow removal above that junction. I mean, what Camp Bird allowed the county to do was to access, instead of going all the way around to get up there, they allowed them to use the private road to gain access, which is much shorter, to the upper level, because that's where they were clearing snow. I mean, they had to clear snow to get on the shorter segment to up there, but that's where they were clearing snow, because that's where the mining activity was happening up there on level 3. Level 14 is actually the level below.
Thank you, Ms. Hurley. Your time's up.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Degenhardt. I'm the Ouray County Attorney. I'm here representing Ouray County. My registration number is 15323. And I didn't know if you all would have had the opportunity to look at the map, so I did provide some color for you to look at. The red claims
that are... You can't see it where it is.
Okay. I just wanted to point out the red claims are, I think the red boxes are what you were talking about, Judge Roy, that are claims owned by the plaintiff, but there's no dispute that the road to that portion is public. The yellow claims shown on the map are the claims that are at issue in this case. It's interesting to note that the actually where the bridge is, which is the bridge that Ouray County owns that the plaintiff stipulates to, part of that sits on the Emily, and so plaintiff has actually asserted that part of it's public, part of it's private, actually on one of the claims that are at issue in this case. The same with the Agnew, which is the conclusion of the road at the bottom. Part of that road the plaintiff has stipulated is public, part of it's private. The green is all Forest Service land. The orange on the map are some other private mining claims that are not at issue in this case. So just to give you a little bit of the lay of the land as we're talking about this. Obviously, you all know this is about a historic road that we believe is a public road and has been a public road since at least 1878. It's compelling, I think, to actually, there's some photographs in the record that you may or may not have seen. They're identified as Triple M, as in Mary. And that sort of shows you the rugged topography, the rugged terrain. And there was a lot of testimony from witnesses who said that because of that topography, where this road is really the only place that the road could be. In fact, Andy Sinti, who was one of our witnesses, who's been a BLM employee for over 50 years, was qualified as an expert on maps and map analysis and mineral surveys, said that this road, his quote was, it hasn't changed appreciably and over this very, very long time, simply because there's no other place for it to be. In the record, you will find there's a number of maps. There are minutes of board meetings that date, as you have mentioned, from 1878, actually all the way to 1977 was the most recent minutes where a representative of Camp Bird had come to the Ouray County Board of Commissioners and asked, when are you going to clear the road for us so we can get to three level up at the top? So,
well, that raises the question I close your opposing counsel's argument with. The road above the junction is public. Everybody understands that and apparently agrees to that. Is there anything in the record that shows that the county actually came in and maintained or removed snow from the road segment in question below that intersection? And if so, when?
There are minutes that reflect the road was repaired and work was done on it in 1910, I want to say. There are some...
Are we sure that's the lower segment?
Yes. Because it was also to Upper Camp Bird. You'll notice sometimes in the minutes they refer to Lower Camp Bird and Upper Camp Bird. And in 1977, those minutes also specifically refer to clearing snow to get access to Upper Camp Bird so that the Camp Bird mine folks could be working at the upper level. So there are at least those minutes that reflect that. There's also evidence in the record that there was a post office at the Upper Camp Bird level. So we believe that that was evidence that, in fact, the road was public and traversed through these mining claims in order to get to Upper Camp Bird for the post office.
And that's the road that starts at Sniffles, the council referred to. Is there any indication of when that road was built?
That road was not completed until, I want to say, 1890. And actually, the photographs that are in the record show a very distinctive landmark, which is called the Hanging Rock. And it's basically a huge rock that had to be blasted through, and that was not completed. And again, I want to say it was 1890. And there's evidence in the record that Otto Mears completed that road at that point in time. So prior to that, certainly, this route that you're talking about, down and around and back up to Sniffles, was the only route that was available because of the topography and the terrain at that time.
Well, my question is more simple than that. Is there any indication that that was, I mean, these things were all trails originally, as I understand the record and the evidence. And so it was wide enough for a man and a mule to go up the hill, okay, and go over Imogene Pass. No, was there a trail where that road is? The road that goes from Sniffles basically up and joins above the road segment in question?
There was none, and may I just show you on the map what we're talking about?
Yes. But you need to pull it out because I can't see the map.
Okay. You'll want to stay near the microphone too so we can pick it up on the recording.
This is up here is County Road 26 and County Road 361, the intersection. This is 361. This is County Road 26, which goes on up to Yankee Boy Basin. The Hanging Rock is about in here. And it was a straight sheer cliff face. There would have been no way for even a mule, it doesn't appear, to have traversed this
road. But that's not the road we're talking about.
We're talking about this road.
No, we're talking about the road that road joins at the south end.
Right.
And goes, there you go. That's the road.
That road, but from this point to up here, there was no trail to get there but for coming around this way. And that's what Dr. Gulliford's testimony was until this road, which ended up being a toll road, and there's evidence in the record of this when it was actually completed and then transferred to the county, until this was completed, there was no access here because of the Hanging Rock. And again, you can see there's a picture of the Hanging Rock and how it looks today, where you have to drive under the rock currently in order to take County Road 26 up into the Yankee Boy Basin. Am I answering your question?
Okay. Yeah, but you're saying that before that time, the road that comes in on this side of the creek from Sniffles, there was no access to it and no way for it to exist.
Up here.
I'm still talking about the Forest Service road.
This road would have hooked up to Yankee Boy up here.
Exactly.
But this portion did not exist.
So there was no access to that road until after 26 was completed.
Correct.
Okay. In about 1890 is, again, the date that sticks in my mind. Quickly on the race judicata issue, I think you all sort of picked up on the issues that we noted in our brief. That particular complaint was very specific, was very distinct. The 14 claims for relief, the 90 defendants who were named, and the plaintiff in that case at that time was very helpful because there was also an appendix where they listed out each defendant, the claim for relief, and the particular mining claims that plaintiff felt at that time each defendant might have an interest in. And it's very clear that Ouray County's interest in that complaint was the Domingo number 2 and the Batanzas. Didn't have anything to do with the claims that are at issue here today. And the disclaimer that was actually filed and authorized to be filed by the Ouray County attorney is very specific. It's also in the record. And what it says is the Board of County Commissioners of Ouray County disclaims any interest in the patented mining claims described only in the 14th claim for relief, and then it lists those three specific mining claims. Doesn't say anything about the claims that are at issue today. The claims that are at issue today had to do only with two banks. There were 140-ish mining claims that were listed in an appendix that they were trying to remove two stale deeds of trust from. That was the claim in the 12th claim for relief. And the judge...
Ms. Degenhart,
yes.
One of the concerns I have is that Ms. Hurley's position is that under Argus and Rule 105, a quiet title action is supposed to be, as I understand it, a once-and-for-all action that's supposed to take care of anybody's possible claims. And the position that you're arguing, of course, is contrary to that, saying that, well, just because there was a quiet title action in 1983, that doesn't preclude another quiet title action in 2005, and then there could be another one in 2015. So what is your response to that?
I think the response is that you have to know what claims you're dealing with in a particular quiet title action. I think the trial court was very clear on that, that you have to read the whole broad scope of the pleadings in that case, and you can't just say a quiet title is a quiet title is a quiet title, and as long as you throw the term quiet title in there, anything, any property that you have included in that, everybody's claims are barred forever and ever and ever. I don't think that's the case law. I don't think that's what Argus says. Mm-hmm. Argus talks about it's bounded by the injury and the claims that are made, and I think this is probably a textbook case for that, because once again the plaintiff was very, very specific about the claims and the injuries that they were trying to address in the 1983 quiet title.
The quiet title action was also against unknown persons who may claim an interest in this action. These claims were involved in that action as one of the claims. The rule requires that if there is an interest of record, you must identify it. And that was done in the quiet title action. But what is the significance of suing all, I mean, when I was in law school, they said you're quieting title against the world, okay? So you put in this against all unknown persons, you serve by publication. Aren't you telling everybody who has an interest in any of these claims listed in this quiet title action, you better come forward?
I think you are to a certain extent. I think in the 12th claim for relief, for example, or let me take the 14th claim for relief, which was the claim against Ouray County, if there were persons out there who thought they owned or had an interest in the Domingo number 2 or the Matanzas, I think they should have come forward and said, hey, wait a minute, we still have an interest in that.
Okay. You were named as to one claim. Why are you not an unknown party as to the claims at question here?
I think specifically with regard to the claims at issue here, I think again you have to go back to the complaint, and plaintiff was not quieting title and asserting that we're quieting title to these 140 claims as against anybody's interest in them. The sole claim for relief with regard to the claims that are at issue here, and let me say there were only four claims at issue here, was to get rid of the deeds of trust.
I'm not saying you're ignoring my question, but I don't think you're answering it. As to the claim involving the Domingo claims where the county had apparently treasurer's deeds, surely the county was an individually named party to that claim because it had a recorded interest. It had to be named under Rule 105. It did not have a recorded interest, and you seem to stipulate to that in the claims involved here. So why is it not an unknown party as to these claims and its claims therefore barred?
Because I think that there was no claim to quiet title to the claims at issue here.
There was.
No, I don't believe there was, and I think the court was correct on that issue. The court said that that with regard to the 12th claim for relief, that the decree did not establish title pursuant to the 12th claim for relief. All it did was remove the stale deeds of trust. There were no allegations that they were saying as to the world, we're quieting title to these 140 mining claims that are at issue in the 12th claim for relief.
Ms. Degenhart, I know your time is swiftly going by. I had two questions I would like you to address. First is I'd like your position on what is the date lands is removed from the public domain, you know, what is the event we look at? And second, I would like you to address Ms. Herlihy's argument about there are no facts showing the public use and the adverse possession. If you could do that, please.
Sure. I believe that the date for the critical date as far as RS 2477 regarding the Glen Monarch is the 1880 date of recordation. And I think the Levy-Masner case supports that. The court in that case, with regard to the homesteader's claim, talks about the entry is properly filed in the appropriate government office. I think it is an affirmative public act that you can actually tie into and know that there's some veracity to it, rather than, as Ms. Herlihy even said in her claim, a minor can say, I located it on any date. And so I think that is that to me is the correct date, is 1880.
So you say it's the date of entry, and entry is defined as a filing in a public office.
That's correct.
Okay.
And with regard to the Dahl and Gwilym cases that she mentioned, those cases talk about a valid claim and a valid entry. And I think valid means that you have complied with all of the prerequisites to a valid location. And in this instance, recordation was a prerequisite to a valid location. With regard to the public issues, I quickly looked back through the trial court's order. The court mentions in page 31 of the order that there was a 1951 Colorado Department of Highways map that showed the road. It talks about between 1952 and 59, mining operations were being conducted. The mines were very busy. People were coming and going. There were no gates. The court does talk about public use there. He mentions specifically the testimony of Mr. Staley. He talks about in the early 60s, several parties combined to create a road from Imogene Basin to Imogene Pass. That's when the tourist traffic started, where they were taking Jeep tours up and down, and Mr. Staley talks about that in his testimony. Talks about in 1961 and 1966 highway maps, again, where the county showed it on the map, and the court
They showed it on the other side of the river. They showed, the maps I've seen show Route 361 marked only on the north side of the river, not north side of the creek. They don't show this segment marked that way.
But it shows it as a road. It shows it as an unimproved trail or an unimproved road. And I don't have...
Yeah, but that doesn't prove public use. That just proves its existence.
But it shows that the county had placed it on its county road maps. And under McIntyre, that's one of the critical issues of the county's claim of right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, we thank all counsel for their excellent briefs and oral presentations. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our 1:30 docket today. The court shall be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.
All right. Court will be in recess, subject to call.